Look at that. Nobody had anything to say. Nobody, no cracking wise before the music started. How about that? Hey, everybody, I'm Kai.
I'm Molly Wood.
Oh, I'm supposed to say Kai Rizdahl, aren't I? I got yelled at about that. Anyway.
I did.
I got yelled at about that.
Look who's cracking wise after the music starts.
That's right.
Just saved
That's
it.
Right. All right, so you know where you are. It's another episode of Make Me Smart, deep dive into tech and culture and the economy, not necessarily in that order. And that's what we're going to do.
As always, we are helped along dramatically by the wisdom and knowledge that you bring to us, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
That is very true. And look, so I apologize in advance, but all you all have some work to do this week, because you have to think and consider and digest dense policy. And I say that not as pejorative, it just is, because we're talking healthcare and we're talking on the eve. Can we even say we're on the eve of the 2020 campaign? We're like already in the middle of it anyway.
We're like in the middle of it.
We're talking healthcare.
I know.
We're talking healthcare and this thing that's out there now called Medicare for All. Bernie Sanders is the most vocal proponent, the most high-profile proponent, I think you could probably say, of Medicare for All. He's actually got a plan out there. And there are others on the Democratic side of the House who are in favor of it. And there's a lot going on. There's a lot that's going to happen in this economy if Medicare for All happens. There's a lot that's going to happen in this society if Medicare for All happens. And that's why we're talking about it.
Yeah, not for nothing. Health insurance companies are already...
You stole my line, by the way.
Not only... talking about it. I did steal it, not for nothing,
yeah,
didn't I?
Yeah, that's all, right.
All credit to TM Kai Rizdahl. I'll just make sure to say that every time.
Yes.
Health insurance stocks have been on a downward trend for the past few months. The CEO of UnitedHealthcare arguably made it a little worse for himself and everybody else on a recent earnings call. David Wichmann, he said that Medicare for All would create a, quote, wholesale disruption of American healthcare, which
is
seems
a big thing to say.
To us like a great place to start.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So we're going to do that with Sarah Cliff. She's a health policy journalist at Vox. She does podcasts there as well. She knows all of this stuff like sideways, which is why we've got her on the pod. Sarah, how are you?
Mm-hmm. I'm great. I'm excited to talk Medicare for All.
No pressure here, because you're basically going to save me and Molly. That's all I'm saying.
All right.
The economy,
all right.
I can talk about. Tech, she can talk about. Healthcare is you. We have to start with a definition, I think, right? Because there are probably lots of people out there who hear these phrases go by and don't necessarily know what they mean. Do me a favor, first of all, and remind us what Medicare is right now.
Medicare right now is a program that covers Americans over 65. It is a program with, I'd say, relatively limited benefits. It covers hospital stays, covers doctor visits. If you want prescription drugs covered, you have to pay extra, and you have a deductible, you have premiums. And a lot of the ways it works, it's actually kind of similar to employer-sponsored insurance, mm-hmm. in that you do have to pay money, even though it is this entitlement program you get when you turn 65.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then who is, all right, step one, out of the way. Then we take Medicare and we expand it to all. Who is the all?
The all,
is it literally all?
It's Kai, it's Molly, it's wow. Sarah, it's everyone listening. It is literally everyone who is in the United States is the all in Bernie Sanders' version of Medicare for All.
So this is what's known as single payer, right? If I could get some more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another way you could describe it. Yep.
OK. So the government pays? Is that the single payer?
Well, the government pays. But as you know, Kai, the government's money comes from all of us.
Well, I didn't want to get to the how are we going to pay for this.
But yes, the government pays.
So the covered is all and paying is all. I get that. But what's interesting, too, is that so that's the Bernie Sanders version. And I feel like we should clarify that, because now, you know, arguably thanks to Senator Sanders and his special brand of stubbornness, now this is a conversation happening all over the place. And in fact, you over at Vox did an analysis of like 9 of these proposals that really do range, which, by the way, good job.
Thank you. It was a lot of pages.
But, then all and who pays and stuff starts to get a little more complicated, right?
It does, because, you know, another conception of Medicare for All is we could all have the option to buy Medicare. And so those plans are usually in the healthcare jargon called Medicare buy-in plans. They're really different from the Sanders plan, which says there is no more private insurance. All of us, we go into the public plan. In the buy-in plans, the all, which again is still all of us, would have the option to buy into Medicare. So maybe you, Molly, would buy Medicare. I like my insurance at Vox, so I would keep it. You know, Kai is debating between the two of them. But we get a choice between the two options. And that's what most of the other plans offered by other senators, not Bernie Sanders. That's how most of them would work.
So acknowledging that there are 3,972 things that have to happen politically before this even becomes a real live issue, actually, on a legislative in a legislative sense, and focusing specifically on Sanders just to avoid muddying the waters. If Medicare for All, as envisioned by Bernie Sanders, comes into effect, then private insurance, generally speaking, goes away, right? My plan goes away at APM. Your plan goes away at Fox, right? And we all now are on the single payer plan.
Yeah. So that would be a huge, huge right. change. And it's different from some international systems. If you look at a place like Britain or Australia, they let people buy private insurance to complement their public insurance. Sanders modeled his plan off of Canada, where all of that goes away. And so there's about 150 million Americans who are getting insurance at work. That would mean all 150 million of us are transitioning onto this new government plan.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a pretty right. big undertaking. So, yeah.
Yes. So that would be a big deal. What would it mean for right. those health insurance companies? Like, would they become some sort of third party provider to the government, or do they just also go poof?
So that is an excellent question. Under the Sanders plan, they would not. Under the Sanders plan, they would go poof, essentially. Or maybe, I don't know, they would like cover some kind of like cosmetic surgery. The Sanders, you know, office, they're often fond of saying insurers will find some way to survive covering, you know, the tiny amount of benefits we don't. But you could see another version of this where they become those kind of third-party administrators. Like if you look at the Netherlands or Israel, they have universal coverage and they do it by having tightly managed competition. And it was interesting, you know, because you've seen, like you were saying earlier, United CEO being quite nervous and a little bit apocalyptic about Medicare for All. That's kind of in contrast to the folks over at Humana, where their CEO has been making some comments like, well, we haven't defined the term. Maybe, you know, we could have a constructive debate. Let's not write it off. My read of remarks like those is like, maybe the government, maybe insurers think that the government would turn to them to actually administer this program since they kind of know how to run health insurance plans.
Mm-hmm. So you remember that phrase that was popular during the Obamacare debate? Obama would say all the time, we need to bend the curve. We need to bend the
yeah.
cost curve, right?
Yes.
And make us spend less money on healthcare, right? And slow the rate of growth of healthcare spending. Would Medicare for All make us spend less money on healthcare?
So that is the idea. And kind of the two big ways, there's kind of two ways you do that in a Medicare for All system. One is by getting rid of some of the administrative costs. This is pretty straightforward. If, you know, the government is the only payer instead of thousands and thousands of payers, you just have a single payer. And dealing with that single payer takes a lot less time and money and jobs than dealing with all these different insurers. The second, though, that's much more controversial and I think difficult to figure out is price regulation. Mm-hmm. So any of these plans, you know, the buy-in ones I was talking about, the Sanders plan, they would all let the government set healthcare prices. But this is where things, I think, get really, really tricky, figuring out how do you set the right price? Because you're trying to balance between making healthcare affordable for all of us, but also giving hospitals and doctors enough money to stay up and running. And finding that right price point, I think that is really, really challenging.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think it would be fair to point out something that the government is not always the best at. Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can even have like rate regulation run amok. Like I wrote some stories about there's a hospital in San Francisco. Yeah. It's actually the largest public hospital. It's named after one Facebook founder, Mark Zuckerberg. And their prices are set by the city of San Francisco. And one of the things that happened is the prices got really high. They just kept approving these like 7 or 8% increases every year. And then all of a sudden, it was like the most expensive hospital in the San Francisco region, even though it was a public or it is a public hospital. So it is hard. And like, you know, I think of one particular price that I wrote about that helps me think through this exercise. I wrote about a family a few years ago that was charged $25,000 for a single MRI. I think like we can all agree like that is too expensive. We could probably lop $10,000 off. The hospital would be fine. We could lop $20,000 off. I don't know, though, when we get down to, like, the actual price of the MRI, like, what is the price that we need for the hospital to keep offering that service? And what is the price where they're going to say, it's just not worth it. The government isn't going to pay us enough, so we're not going to offer, you know, MRI imaging. Like, there are big outlier cases mm-hmm. that are easy to think about, but then the actual, like, well, what should it cost? Like, that's a really hard debate.
So there are a bunch of, so that's one of the transition issues, right, is setting those price points. The other one is just the infrastructure that we have in place now. And what happens, you know, there's one plan out there that calls for a 2-year transition. Sanders, I think, calls for a 4-year transition.
Right.
What happens as we try to dissolve is too strong, but it's close, right? Dissolve one system and start up with another one in an economy that's, you know, 150 million people are getting health care in this economy.
Yeah. And this feels like, you know, one of the consequences of not tackling healthcare for so long is the fact we have this huge infrastructure. So, like, when Canada built its single payer system in 1962, they had this fledgling little insurance system. Most people didn't have private insurance. You know, we have a situation where there's, like I said, 150 million people on private insurance. You know, the plan you mentioned, Kai, that is the shorter transition, that's offered by Pramila Jayapal in the House. She co-chairs the House Progressive Caucus. When I've talked to her about this, she says, yes, it's quick, but her expectation is once you say Medicare for All is coming, once you tell insurers, like, your industry is ending, you might have this very quick collapse. And that's why she thinks it's really important to transition quickly, because insurers might just flee the business mm-hmm. when they know it's coming to an end. You know, the Sanders team takes the view that you need these they're less worried about collapse. They feel like they need this on-ramp, that it won't, you know, that insurers will stick with it for those years they have left, because, like, what else are they going to do? Mm-hmm. But it's a big unknown. You know, I can't tell you what happens when you end the private insurance company, because we haven't really tried anything like that.
Right. And I wonder, is there any precedent for this? Like, have any of the other countries that currently have some version of single payer enacted this type of transition, or would this be pretty much a giant real-time experiment?
So there are some, but there aren't a lot. Mm-hmm. I'd say Taiwan is probably the most recent country that has gone into a single payer system, and it went relatively smoothly. You know, they had a pretty fast transition, but it's actually, I was kind of fascinated by the history of Canada's healthcare program, because I didn't realize this until a few weeks ago, and I spent all my time thinking about healthcare. The doctors in Canada, they went, yeah, it's a very exciting life I lead.
Right.
So I learned a few weeks ago, when Canada launched single payer, and this was just in the province of Saskatchewan, the doctors went on strike for 3 weeks. Wow. Like, they would not go to work. They were so angry. And, you know, right now, I think Canadians love their healthcare system, and, like, the doctors are really proud and want to talk to you about it. But back in 1962, you know, the hospitals essentially shut down. The emergency rooms were running, and they were running because doctors flew in from Britain to staff them. So it was wild. Yeah, it's just crazy. Weird that people we don't hear more about Saskatchewan history. I don't know why that is.
We're going to have people from Saskatchewan kind of, write in, I'm telling you.
It made me think, you know, it's going to be hard, but not impossible. Like, it's really impressive to me when I've talked to some Canadian historians about this moment. They say, like, this was really a moment where it could have gone either way. The doctors were so angry. They were actually, like, burning effigies of the premier of Saskatchewan, this guy Tommy Douglas, who had created the whole program. And these are, like, some, you know, usually Canadians are mild-mannered people. So it's hard. And they had a much less developed health insurance system than the one we have in the U.S. right now.
Right. All right. So look, with the caveat that we spend $700 billion a year in the Pentagon in this economy without batting an eye, much of the hullabaloo about Medicare for All has been about, oh my goodness, it's going to cost so much. What's your sense of how much it might cost? Pick your variation of the plans that are out there. And then, is that a bar to actually having a real conversation about it?
So I'm not going to give you a number figure, because I think that would be because I would be out ahead of my skis. But I would think a Medicare for All system would cost less than what we spend on healthcare now, which I think is like a helpful benchmark to use. I think some of those gains in administrative costs combined with, like, any level of price regulation would probably mean we spend less. That being said, that's like the number.
Wait, can I interrupt and ask you if you have a number? Do you have a number figure on what we spend now, just as a ballpark?
It's about a seventh of the economy, right?
Yeah. So it's 18% or so of the economy. Yeah. It's 2 point something trillion. I don't know the point. And that is large behind that decimal
under
point.
Under that.
In the trillions. Yes. I think we would spend less, even though we'd be covering more people. My view is with the improvements in administrative costs, the lower prices, I buy the rhetoric from Sanders that it would cost less. However, that is a big, big net figure. And that masks a lot of distributional changes in who pays what. I think wealthier people would probably find the system more expensive because of the different taxing options that the Sanders campaign has thrown out. They would likely find that their health insurance benefits or the amount they spend on health insurance is going up, you know, especially if you're in the top 1%, the top 0.1%. And likewise, I think some people who earn less would see their costs go down. So I think, I don't know, I find that more useful to talk about kind of who pays what. And I feel like that's where we know less. But I think that's going to determine a lot about the political viability of a program like this one.
So you actually just snuck in a phrase there that seems relevant on this one, taxing options. So in some way, shape or form, we're going to have to open up the tax code again.
Yeah.
Right. And oh, my goodness, remember that one from 2 years ago.
Yes. So, yeah, we're going to have to open up the tax code. Huh. You know, when I look at the things that Sanders has talked about, he's talked about a lot of taxes on millionaires and billionaires. But he's also talked about, you know, it's interesting. He will say in a lot of speeches, there's no premiums. But then if you look at, you know, what he's put out on financing options, there's like an X percent employer side premium and an X percent individual side premium that you'd essentially be paying through your taxes rather than, you know, handing over to an insurance company.
Right.
I mean, I feel like, you know, on the one hand, this conversation, Medicare for All, is like a lot more real than any of us probably would have imagined a few years ago.
Even like 4 years ago, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. And yet, we're still also talking about like two-third rails simultaneously, right? Like completely overhauling healthcare and the tax code again. I mean, how likely is this really?
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't have a crystal ball on this one. I think if Sanders wins the presidency, it is hard for me to see him not making a real serious push for this. You know, if I think of some of the other candidates who have endorsed single payer, but it's not like their thing. I'm thinking of someone like a Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren. I don't know if they'd put the political capital into this. But then I look at someone like Sanders and I think like they might try. And Sanders had talked about some ways to get around the filibuster, which is also another huge issue in this, or the Senate rules that make it very, very difficult to do this. But, you know, so on the like short term horizon, I don't think it's likely. But there's a lot of people who are really frustrated with the healthcare system. And I think that's the only reason we're having this discussion. If Obamacare had fixed everything, Democrats would not be like dying to jump into another politically toxic healthcare debate. Yeah. It's because people are frustrated. They feel like the system isn't working for them. That's why I think this debate just doesn't go away.
Sarah Cliff covers the hell out of healthcare. I'll tell you what, at Vox.
Yep.
Medicare for All was the subject today. Sarah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Craziness.
Yeah, thank you.
Craziness. We'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, there we go. Now we understand Medicare for All. I'm done. Let's go home.
Yeah.
No?
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye, guys. You know, that Overton window just never stops moving.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what. And if you're not reading Sarah's book,
honestly, and the stuff she did, the stuff she did on Zuckerberg's San Francisco hospital, it's stunning. First of all, actually, the way the billing was done there, and also the impact her coverage has had, because now San Francisco is actually changing the way it is because of Sarah's reporting. It's awesome. Anyway, send us your thoughts, actually, about Medicare for All and healthcare as a part of the 2020 campaign, which is, underway. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voice memo. It's better. We'll get you on the pod, and it'll be cool.
Better.
Yeah.
In fact, you are very shortly going to hear a few excellent examples of said voice memos from listeners sharing their experiences with the gig economy. But first, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with our fixations.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
Wow. All right. We're back. Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Who wants to go? You want to go? You want me to go? I've actually got one and a half. I've got a not-so-secret hidden one, but I just didn't feel like putting it in there.
Ooh.
I know, right? I'm breaking the rules. Get a load of me. Kai Rizdahl, rule breaker.
I hope it's the thing that I'm sort of wanting to insert, but I'm trying to, like, be disciplined today.
Oh, all right.
Well, I feel like I need to start with a quick follow-up, and then maybe we can do yours and then come back to my real fixation. Which is, that will teach me talk about a gadget for any reason, including a thing that is supposedly objectively cool. Remember last week when I was like, hey, you know what I'm kind of into right now is this new Samsung Galaxy Fold.
I do. I remember that. I remember that pretty well.
Because what an accomplishment. It's objectively cool, even though if it's really expensive. And, you know, like at least they're pushing the technology envelope. Turns out... they may have pushed the technology envelope too far, too fast, because all of you, including one only slightly snotty Kai Rizdahl, sent me the stories about how they just like are breaking left and right, and there's like a bubble in the fold part, because it turns out that maybe making a folding screen is
$2,000.
Nobody had bought it. Right. Anyway, now it's the news of this matter is that, in fact, the April 26th launch date.
Postponed.
Has been postponed.
Yes. All right. You want to keep going? Your other one?
The end.
Your other one?
My other one is that I've been very interested in the Pinterest IPO.
Oh. What do they call people who are on Pinterest? Are you a Pinterester?
A pinner.
A pinner. So of course. Are you a pinner?
I'm not like a super regular pinner, but I definitely have been a pinner. In fact, I was saying last week that I went on to Pinterest and looked because the IPO came and I was like, was coming. I think it happens this week. And I realized that apparently the only thing I'm interested in life is really elaborate Halloween parties. that's all my pins. All of them. I got like two classic cars and some Danish design and then like 10,000 Halloween party ideas.
That is pretty fun.
That is my jam.
Man.
But there's a great story. And I had actually been noticing this. What's funny is that I noticed this headline that I thought was sort of condescending about how Pinterest is relying on its like folksy charm.
Yeah.
And then that same author at Quartz wrote a really great story last week about how the coverage of Pinterest and its IPO is generally super sexist and dismissive because this is a platform that primarily two-thirds of its 250 million monthly active users, by the way, are women. And that the coverage of that and of the demographics is just like really dismissive. And it always has these little like dumb puns in it as opposed to being like, oh, yeah, turns out they buy stuff, too. Pretty basic. But I've noticed that I have a friend who recently went to work for Stitch Fix, which is a highly successful company with just like so much user passion.
Yep.
And gets the same treatment constantly.
The whole deal. Yeah.
Founded by a woman, exactly, and has constantly gotten the same treatment as like a chick company. I mean, not, you know, and now it you can buy clothes for men and for children too, but also chicks spend a lot of money on clothes and decorating and Halloween party. Like it's just like I can't believe this story is still happening.
It. Right.
Is my fixation. Right. Yes.
Fair enough.
The end.
And look, it's yes to all of the things that Molly said about that, because it's ridiculous. All right, I'm going to get a little geeky here on tariffs, and I apologize for this, but there is yet more evidence that the president's tariffs are making things more expensive for American consumers. And spoiler alert, that's the way tariffs are supposed to work. There's a paper out today on the president's washing machine tariffs, which actually predate the steel and aluminum tariffs. They predate the car tariffs he's been talking about. They were among the first tariffs that the president put into effect when he took office. He raised tariffs on imported washing machines by 25%. And lo and behold, domestic washing machine manufacturers took advantage of that price increase on imported washing machines to raise their own prices. So now, to the tune of $1.5 billion, Americans are out of pocket because of the president's tariffs on washing machines. And I just wanted to point out.
But he said we're making so much money.
We are making so much money. Care. Yes. Mm-hmm, that's right. Actually, no, that's not true. Uh-huh. So look, here's the deal. This is the way tariffs are supposed to work. And if you're not paying attention, then you pay attention to the president's stuff where he says we're making bajillions of dollars. And we're not. It raises costs for American consumers because tariffs are paid by Americans. And that's all I really wanted to say. Just bear that in mind. When the president talks about economics, he is frequently misleading or uninformed. That's all I'm going to say. That's my item. You want the half item now? Should you want me to do it or you want to do it? Because
I think we're
talking about the same thing.
I bet we are.
There was a Twitter thread this weekend by a woman named Abigail Disney of the Disneys. And she's not a highfalutin person in the company. She owns some shares of the company, but that's about it. But she had a thread. It had to have been 30 tweets about Bob Iger's pay. Bob Iger being the chairman and CEO of the Walt Disney Company. Bob Iger makes approximately $11 gajillion a year. And he's gotten a bonus of another 11 gajillion. I'm exaggerating, but not by much. And Abigail Disney's point was, holy cow, I love Bob Iger and he's done great things for our company. But think of all the things you can do for the people who work at Disney with all that money. And it was a whole long thread, really well reasoned and really well thought out about the consequences of the disparities in executive pay and worker pay, and it's bananas. I encourage you to go read it. I'm pretty sure her Twitter handle is Abigail Disney. I tweeted it out the other day, so you can find it on my timeline. It was really interesting, and it's all about, as Molly said in a tweet today, it's all about whether capitalism works for as many people as it should.
It really is, and it's. I remember, I don't know, around 2008, maybe I have one friend who raised this idea in my mind, and she is the person who said, shouldn't there be a moral cap on the amount that executives get paid? Couldn't and wouldn't that moral cap still mean that they got paid a ton of money? And one of the examples she gave is like, what if you said, I'm a public company? What if the SEC said, you're a public-facing company, a publicly owned company, your CEO is not allowed to make over 1,000 times as much as your lowest
socialism. That's socialism, Molly. How dare you say that?
Right. And we would say that, and that would be crazy.
And everybody would go bananas.
And also some number of people would say 1,000 times more, and I am here to tell you
but
that, in fact, that's the accurate number, and Abigail Disney, in her first tweet in this thread, points out that by any objective measure, especially at a company, by the way, that has significant numbers of employees who make minimum wage, which we know from recent housing data is actually not enough to afford a two-bedroom apartment in any state in America, she writes that by any objective measure, a pay ratio of over 1,000 is insane.
Go read the thread.
And it's great.
Abigail Disney.
It's a great thread.
Yeah, it's really good.
And maybe it's time for us to do another, maybe we could do like a moral capitalism style episode that's about executive pay.
Mm. No, it's part of it, right? It's part of it.
Or maybe we just did it. I don't know.
it's entirely possible. All right. we are moving on. Your turn. And your turn goes on for a ways this week because you had some things to say about the gig economy. We talked about them last week. Gig economy IPO is specifically Lyft and Uber's coming and what that's going to mean for the way this labor force changes. And we asked you what kinds of gig jobs you have outside the typical Lyft and Uber side hustles. And we also coined a phrase, by the way. Well, we didn't, but our guest did this whole idea of anchor jobs, and then you can have some side hustles along the way. Anyway, got lots of responses.
We really did. And tons of people were like, oh, yeah, my anchor job is this, and my side hustle is this. Yeah. Like, completely, apparently, this is just so much more normal than we even realized.
Yep.
A lot of you also pointed to gig work in academia, and many of you are on the adjunct professor merry-go-round, which is almost like the original sin when it comes to gig workers. Like, adjunct professorship sounds like the biggest scam going. Yep. However, in some ways, as part-time jobs go, it can be good. It comes with this prestige. You're associated with a major institution. But these gigs don't provide benefits, and they pay for nothing. Listener Casey Cook teaches adjunct at American University in Washington, D.C., and told us more about it.
I am a musician. I'm classically trained, and I have a doctoral degree in conducting. I feel like music has kind of invented the idea of the gig economy, the idea of having a day job and your gigs at night. But I've been doing, I guess, anchor jobs and side hustles for the past 15 years. So I went looking for things that were sort of adjacent to my field and found a job at a nonprofit. Working at this nonprofit has been able to give me things like health insurance and enough flexible time to go out and continue doing musically rewarding things that I wanted to do when I started. So I'm able to sort of use both of my positions, my anchor job and my side hustles, all to do the same kind of work. Not at all what I thought my job would be when I started pursuing music as a degree path way back in the 90s, but here I am.
So this, by the way, is a chorus that Casey conducted. It's called it's Mozart's Requiem Sanctus and Benedictus, as somebody out there surely knows, without me even
I recognize it immediately.
You shut up. Oh man, oh my god. All right, so that was the audio arts, if you will, the choral mm-hmm. arts. We're gonna do visual arts next. Maheen Ruby is an artist. She does drawing, painting, other formats as well. She says when you're creative and that's your gig, you need a lot of gigs to keep your head above water. And she tells us how she does it.
I'm a visual artist, but I wear a bunch of different hats. I work 3 days a week part-time at a nonprofit arts education and mentoring program. Right now, I have a freelance client and I'm illustrating a book about 2 to 3 days a week. To make ends meet, I teach drink and paint classes, I sell my work through my online store, and I take odd domestic jobs. I've consistently worked 2 to 6 jobs at a time for the last 5 years. I'm exhausted, and I desperately want just one job that covers everything. And then I could take illustrations on the side for fun instead of necessity. I really stand by the quality of the work that I produce, and I just wish that my work was worth the benefits to help me take care of myself.
Yeah, totally. Also, drink and paint, what is that? That sounds hazardous. I'm just saying, whatever drink
awesome.
And paint classes are. Yeah, or awesome, conceivably. But yeah, look, her point's real. I mean, you know, yeah. 2 to 6 jobs, God.
That's heartbreaking. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking how many of these stories, including our next one, ultimately are related to creative arts in some form.
Yeah.
Because there is also the Nights and Weekends entrepreneur who you're going to hear from now, Adam Smith from Cleveland, no relation, is to the economics guy. See what I did there? Because Adam Smith.
Nice.
Never mind.
No, you did good. That's like me
Adam
pulling
Smith
some tech
Cleveland.
Thing out of the wazoo, man. It's like, what about David Hewlett, that guy? Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
It's only funny when you explain the joke. All right. Adam Smith from Cleveland is a full-time woodworker by day. His side hustle gig does not rely on an institution or a digital platform. It's actually a culinary skill that he's turned into a business.
I figured if there's something I enjoy doing or I love doing, I might as well make it a little bit more than a hobby. So about 7 years ago, I got my LLC in liability insurance and a couple extra coolers and started Cleveland on the Half Shell.
A little bit of a horseradish into it.
It's a one-man operation. I provide an oyster shucking service. I do a few gigs a month. It doesn't pay all the bills, but it certainly helps out. Now I'm shucking oysters and making a few dollars. And meeting people.
These are out of Prince Edward Island, PEI. They're called Raspberry Points.
But it'd be kind of nice to make woodworking a hobby and oyster shucking a full-time deal, and maybe even franchise.
Awesome.
Interesting,
also, I would
right?
like
That's
to
cool.
Exit the show now and go out for oysters.
Yeah, right?
That sounded so
yeah,
fun.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, everybody finds a way, but it does feel like it's yeah. sometimes more work than it needs
to
be.
Keep sending them. Your mm-hmm. your anchor job, mm-hmm. your side hustle, whatever it is, how you get by in this gig economy, if you're one of the millions of people out there working in this gig economy, it's makemesmart@marketplace.org. Send us a voice memo, and we'll get you on the pod. Okay. Next question, the standard question, make me smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about? Physics teacher Jennifer Childress is from Anchorage, Alaska.
My answer to the Make Me Smart question pertains to teaching. When I first started teaching, I was very focused on the content. I felt the responsibility of making sure that students learned all of the facts and equations, ideas, and laws of physics. I was sure that they would need to know all of this as they moved on to their next courses. Over the years, my understanding of what is essential in teaching has changed. Although the content is certainly important, the critical elements that I teach students are the skills of synthesizing information and problem solving. I hope that I've helped students gain the skills and confidence to respond to life's unexpected situations. Thanks for creating such a great show. Bye.
Yeah, so amen, right? And that goes to my mm-hmm. my corollary to her thesis here, which is that you're not in school to get straight A's, kids. I'll deny this if you repeat it to your parents, but you're really not. You're there to learn how to think. right? Whether it's high school or college or whatever it is, learn how to think and learn how to live. That's all I got.
Yeah. We've been having this discussion actually in my household a lot about executive function, which it turns out 12-year-old boys are not awesome at. Well, but it's like the whole goal apparently of sixth grade is to try to learn this, and it's a whole thing. It's unevenly distributed. Let me just say that. but it is really interesting, and it's hard to pull back from, like, well, you have to do the homework and just do the math thing over and over and over, as instead of what you have to learn is how to organize your binder.
Right. No, that's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's totally right. Yep. Totally right.
We should note here that Jennifer recently gave a speech recognizing her honor high school graduates. And the main theme of the speech was the Make Me Smart question and our show. I feel like we should send her some stickers for her students. Can we do that? Yes. Yeah. Great.
And
thanks.
I think we should get her a t-shirt, right? Do we have any t-shirts left?
Yeah.
Look at this. I'm not even looking at the producers because they're just kind of going, oh, my
don't
God.
Don't look at them. They're freaking out. Send her one of those nice notebooks. Okay, I'm going to stop. I'm stopping.
Just get her.
We're going to get in trouble.
Send her up a care package.
What is your answer to the Make Me Smart question? Which, once more, is what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Like, I thought the fence guys were going to be done working on the fence today, but they're not. In case you can hear that. Send us a...
Our fence guys 3 weeks ago discovered an old gas line that we didn't know was an old gas line. And so they nicked it as they were digging. And my wife calls me and she's like, I think we're going to have a gas problem. Yeah, so...
Like, does that ever not happen?
I think that always happens.
Make
it's
me
like
smart at marketplace.org. It's probably happening right now, right outside the window.
Probably. Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Mars. The senior producer is Eve Troh. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Looking behind the camera, is he really there? Okay, I just got to check.
I heard him.
Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me two. Anyway, theme music was composed by... You heard him, really? I didn't hear him. Theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
Daniel Ramirez only talks to me. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Heathcote and Summer Dunmore. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager, hey Deb, how are ya? Hey Deb, is Deborah.
She's not listening. She's
not listening.
She's not listening.
I'm saying
hi.
You can
say hi till the cows come
enthusiastically.
Home. She's not listening all the way to the end, I'm telling you. How do I know that?
I feel like end of the pod should just become, now we've had 2 weeks in a row, like things that are happening outside Molly's window. Because last week it was
last
the spider
week
babies,
spiders.
And now it's the fence.
So I watched the video of you talking about the spiders. Whew, man.
Dude, I looked so... It was
you looked
so
a little horrified.
You know what I should have done is I should have taken the camera over. Well, I took a picture.
Oh, well, now you got to put it out there. You got to put it on our website or something.
Colony.
Are they gone now? Are they still there? Are they hatched? What's going on with them?
I just sprayed down the entire side of that house, and I went around with a broom, and I found so many spider nests. So basically, I'm a monster.
Bye, everybody.
I just power washed the freaking... God. House, but I can't power wash the fence,
no,
guys.
Molly, don't spray me. No. All right, I gotta go. Bye.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening. Because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.